Welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and our discussion right now will focus on the issue of crime and punishment and the need for criminal justice reform. In fact, there's a bipartisan meeting recently in Washington, D.C. Both sides of the aisle, as I say. Ken Blackwell joins us. He was there. He was part of the summit. He's a former mayor of Cincinnati, and he works with Family Research Council. In fact, recently wrote an article for the Washington Examiner, Federal Criminal Justice Reform is Long Overdue. Mr. Blackwell, welcome to the program.
Jerry, good to be with you.
Okay, so go ahead and tell us why the criminal justice system needs an overhaul.
Well, I think all we have to do is look at the numbers. The U.S. has less than 5% of the world's population, but nearly a quarter of the world's prison population. 60% of the people in prison today are people of color, and that has always given me pause for concern. And one in three black men face the likelihood of imprisonment. My approach to this, after looking at all of the research and having firsthand knowledge as not only a mayor of Cincinnati but a former U.S. Former Undersecretary of the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development, is that the comprehensive research on criminal sentencing unequivocally points to a simple fact. When we incarcerate first-time nonviolent offenders with hardened criminals, those first-time offenders often become hardened criminals themselves. And so a bipartisan group of us have decided to take a hard look to see if there's any way that we can divert those nonviolent first-time offenders from the prison population and give them an opportunity to reform and rehabilitate and to get their lives together and have opportunity for productive citizenship and employment.
So is the key word here nonviolent offender?
Yeah,
nonviolent?
For me, and that has gotten a lot of people to take a hard look at the problem. Look, I, as a former mayor, I was concerned first and foremost with the safety of our neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I realized when I had an opportunity to look at the prison population and our system from a federal perspective as an undersecretary at HUD, it became very clear to me that when you overcrowd your prisoners, your prisons with non-violent prisoners and you incorporate them or integrate them with hardened prisoners and you have a prison overcrowding, what happens is that you wind up putting bad guys and violent criminals back on the street to clear space for the next round. And so if we could actually divert nonviolent first-time offenders from prison, we reduce the likelihood that they become hardened criminals, and we, in fact, can make sure that violent criminals and repeat offenders are kept in prison.
Mm. You know, the late Chuck Colson did a lot of work towards prison reform, even founded Prison Fellowship, a great Christian ministry and so forth. But I remember he saying that when he first went to prison for Watergate-related crimes, so white collar, there were about 200,000 prisoners in America. And then by the 90s or maybe the early 21st century, there were about 2 million prisoners in America. Quite a growth.
Oh, absolutely. Right now we have about 2.3 million American adults are incarcerated in prisons and jails nationwide. That means more than 1 in 100 adults are now behind bars in our country. And the cost of doing nothing is too high. One estimate puts the cost of reduced employment opportunities for ex-offenders, for instance, at well over $55 billion per year. And if we, in fact, could, again, divert those first-time, non violent folks who might have just made a bad judgment, but are basically good people. We can, in fact, turn this situation around. But it starts with us taking a bipartisan approach across ethnic, racial, income levels, you name it. It takes a community-wide effort to get this done.
But if you do the crime, you should do the time, right?
If you do the crime, you should do the time, but it doesn't mean that you should do the time in prison. If, in fact, it was the first time, if, in fact, it was nonviolent, so that means that we can do this in smarter, more productive ways that actually can keep families intact. Because once you start the cycle of breaking up of families and having young children, particularly young men, growing up in fatherless homes, what we have is a recipe for continued increasing the prison population, increasing the underproductivity of many of our citizens, and perpetuating a system that does not rehabilitate, but in most cases create, you know, more productive criminals, and that's contrary to what we want to do.
Well, now you believe in the Bible, correct?
That's right.
All right, the Bible puts emphasis on restitution. You know, unless it's a so serious a crime that it should be a, basically a capital offense. But if somebody steals, then they should pay back four times, in fact. You know, I think restitution is a definitely a worthy goal and could help some of these first-time offenders, you know, learn their lesson and never do it again.
Oh, absolutely. I have no problem with that. I couple the Bible's lessons on restitution with the powerful lesson of the Bible is life doesn't just begin in the beginning, but the life lesson is that we, in fact, can begin again through, you know, God's grace and God's forgiveness. And I really do think that, you know, we have to be smart about it. We have to be fair about it. But we, in fact, can blend both of those things in terms of making sure that folks, you know, pay back for their crime, but we can construct it in a way that doesn't put them on a path of becoming hardened criminals. And it starts with believing in the powerful lesson of the transformational power of Christ, that in fact they can begin again and be better people.
All right, suppose you were dictator of the United States and you had complete control and everything you wanted to do related to criminal reform, you could do at your fingertips. What four things would you do beyond the point you've already made to separate the nonviolent first-time offenders and to basically keep them from going to prison but then forcing them to do some other sort of punishment or restitution or whatever, but what else would you do?
Well, again, I try to start on things what I call low-hanging fruit, where we can build consensus, and that is that if we can build a consensus around the fact that our nation needs public safety-focused sentencing reform that keeps dangerous and violent criminals behind bars and rehabilitates offenders who can become productive citizens, that, you know, that encompasses not only just one step, but two or three. And so, again, my whole program is to start this, my involvement in this program starts with my belief that we need reduce prison overcrowding, reduce prison violence, and create ways that save billions of tax dollars that can be put back into building not only safe neighborhoods, but neighborhoods that are or that are actually opportunity neighborhoods for productive citizens.
We're talking right now with Ken Blackwell of Family Research Council, and he was a participant at a bipartisan summit held in Washington, D.C., actually last week. Actually, this is being recorded on the very week it happened, on Friday. And this is on behalf of Safe Justice Act. Explain to us the Safe Justice Act, this bipartisan push for reform of our prison system.
But this, it's an act to that actually looks at how we begin to not be soft on criminals, but being smarter on crime. And it is a series of policy steps that reduces future criminal activity and makes our communities across America safer by, again, being public safety focused in sentencing reform. It is a it talks about diversion of first-time nonviolent offenders to community-based corrections programs, for instance. And so it is a comprehensive approach to dealing with the fact that, again, we, as I stated before, have less than 5% of the world's population, but nearly a quarter of the world's prison population, and the fact that one in 100 adults in our country now are behind bars.
Yeah, but you know, when you keep bringing that statistic up about our population versus the rest of the world, hey, there's parts of the world I just don't even want to travel in because it's unsafe. So at least some of these laws on the books in America, at least, try to keep us safe.
Well, and again, there's nothing in what we're talking about that would keep us unsafe. It basically is a way to separate nonviolent first-time offenders from the hardened criminal element that are now in our prisons, and it would in fact clear our prisons so that we don't deal on early release programs with hardened criminals just because of overcrowding.
Yeah.
So this is being smart. It's being focused on keeping you, your family, and other families and other individuals across the country safe, but it's also dealing with a way to keep families intact, give folks a second chance in a way that they can actually become productive citizens as opposed to being on a track of becoming harder criminals.
You know, this is going to sound crazy, but your boss is Tony Perkins, right, at the Family Research Council. And Tony actually hosted a program that I helped produce about hate crime laws. And if hate crime laws become enforced to the point where you basically can't express a politically incorrect view in public, you might end up having a situation where people of goodwill, decent people, end up going to jail only because of their opinions, which are politically incorrect, and not because they've, you know, stolen from anybody.
Yeah, I mean, first, the attack on religious liberty is something that we must not give in to as a society. It is first of our basic human rights, and is something that I've defended on the international stage. So first, let's not give in to this attack on this fundamental human right in America. We must continue to underscore just how ludicrous these and dangerous these attacks are because of the situation that you just outlined, where people in the public square living their religious values could in fact be criminalized is something that we must resist.
Mm-hmm.
We need to focus on a broken criminal justice system, and we need to focus on ways, again, to be smarter about how we fight crime, smarter about how we help these first-time nonviolent offenders lift themselves up from what was a mistake in judgment in their lives.
Yeah,
and that's something that Chuck Colson lived by. He
sure.
understood that. He understood that there are folks who need to be given not only a second chance, but a path to rehabilitation before they choose a path of hardened criminal activity.
Ken Blackwell, do you have a website you want to refer us to?
Well, you always come to frc.org, look under the experts, and keep up with all of my writings and presentations across the country.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
God bless.